right, if the clerk will please announce counsel for parties.
May I please report, Mr. Shelby Sharp will argue for the appellant, and Mr. Gerald Spade will argue for the appellant.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. This is an appeal of a final decree of divorce following a jury and bench trial that is, to understate it, replete with due process issues. Even as children, there is a sense within us, this is just, or this is just not right. This is unjust. We have before you two basic areas of determinative issue, and the first that I feel compelled to address is, does this court have jurisdiction of this appeal? I think that is the thing that I have got to decide, and until you decide that issue in my favor, you can't reach the merits of those issues that were just flat wrong. But I want to also be able to give you some facts concerning your determination of the jurisdiction issue that also shows it is replete with due process problems, unparalleled that I've seen in any written opinion or my own personal experience. Now, let me focus on the jurisdiction issue, and that is this. At the conclusion of the bench trial following the jury trial, the court signed a final judgment. Motion for new trial was timely filed, and it was denied. But in conjunction with the denial, the court considerably modified the final judgment by taking out a lot of religious holidays. A timely file motion for new trial was filed to this modified judgment. Now we begin to get into the problems. This timely file motion for new trial was not heard by the trial judge, who had a vacation scheduled, but it was heard by an elected sitting judge, Judge Cosby, at the permission of the judge who tried it. Judge Cosby granted the motion for new trial, and when the judge who tried the case returned from vacation, he set it aside, plus he set aside findings of fact that were heard by another judge that made those. Now, this court has ruled that if there is an appointed judge, only he can hear the case and nobody else can hear it. That's what this court has ruled. Now, with all due respect to the court, I think that decision is just flat wrong for one primary reason. You're giving a judge more power than an elected judge has. And I don't think that that would fly if it got down to Austin, and that issue has never come before Austin. But this court has held that an appointed judge is the only one who can decide it. Now, let me address that problem, and here's where the injustice comes in. You have the appointed judge who gives permission to another judge to hear the motion for new trial. Then when it comes back, because he has granted it, he says, you didn't have the power to do that, and I'm setting it aside. Now, there's something innately wrong about that, but that's what happened. Now, when he sets it aside, a timely file motion for new trial to that order is filed, and it is set for a hearing. But in the meantime, Mr. Rosenstein decides he wants to get some help from the bankruptcy court, and so he seeks bankruptcy relief, and everything goes on hold until the stay is finally lifted in bankruptcy court. Then that motion for new trial is heard, it is denied, and this appeal is timely filed. Now, the issue comes up. That order that set aside Judge Cosby's granting of the motion for new trial on the basis that he didn't have the authority to do that and is void, therefore, your time for appeal is back here, and therefore, you're out of luck. period, at that point. You're totally out of luck. Now, I don't think, just speaking from the playground, that when the teacher says, teacher so-and-so can decide this, and then teacher who gave that permission said, no, I don't like that. But by the way, because I did that, and this is what happened, you're out of luck. You have no recourse, no relief. I don't think that should be the law. I have great appreciation for our procedural rules and substantive rules, as we all do. We know that they're designed to reach a just result. They're not designed to thwart justice, but to reach it. And generally speaking, following those rules and following the substantive law, we get there. But there's no question in the first part of whichever of you three lucked out and drew this opinion, you're going to have to address that part of what about a judge who's appointed to try it and this court's of record having held thus and so, and when that judge lets another judge hear it, and then comes back and sets it aside, what do you do? And that's something you're going to have to address and deal with. I believe just from a plain due process point of view, a trial judge should not be permitted to do that and then to the detriment of the party who had suffered it. Yes, ma'am.
All right, if we have one set of rules, and our court has said only the appointed judge can hear things, and yet repeatedly you have judges who are appointed to do specific things like hear a motion to recuse,
mm-hmm.
Pick a jury in a death penalty case, and then those judges go on their way.
Mm-hmm. That's correct, ma'am.
They are appointed for a specific purpose. They come in, they do what they're appointed for. They don't handle the whole case. So in practice, hasn't any suggestion that the appointed judge has to do everything been done away with or ignored? Because the appointed judge in many cases doesn't handle the entire case.
And I agree with that, because that's the reality. I mean, that's what it is. But the basis upon which the trial judge set this aside as void was based on your opinion that says, once I'm appointed for the deal, then I've got the whole case and no other judge can do anything, because you had a judge who made findings of fact. You had a sitting judge elected who set the thing aside. And, you know, you get two judges making findings of fact and conclusions of law and setting something aside. They've got a problem, because most motions for new trial are not granted. It's a rare thing they're granted. And something must have really moved Judge Cosby to say, hey, this thing's got to be set aside and a new trial needs to go. And then now, all of a sudden, his order is, quote, void. But the basis upon which the trial judge made it was on your opinion that says, once you have a judge assigned to the case, he has to decide all. That was his basis of his ruling, and that's what's of record in there. So that's something you're going to have to address in deciding this jurisdictional issue. Now, I'd like to move to the bench trial, because here we step in to another mess. You had a jury trial that went for some considerable period of time, and the jury comes back with a verdict awarding the mother the right to determine the residence of the children. Then the next day you have a bench trial begin, and you have the lady who just won's attorney saying, judge, we didn't know there was going to be a bench trial today, and my client's not here. Now, considering she got a favorable verdict, that bench trial is something she's looking forward to, not something she's wanting to duck. And then you have quoted in the record that, and this is from the trial judge, quote, not sure that the attorney for Mrs. Rosenstein was listening carefully, and this is in conjunction with the announcement that there was going to be a bench trial the next morning. I mean, so he even had in his mind that they may not have heard it. Now, Why in the world would he force a bench trial following a long jury trial that the party says, hey, we didn't know this was going to happen. We are not ready. And he ignores
that. But
wasn't
there something on the record where counsel for the wife actually asked for a clarification as to what time the hearing would start the next day?
Not that I recall in the record. You may be correct on that, but I don't recall that. It's my understanding from reading the record that trial counsel thought they were going to meet with the judge and make a decision on when the bench trial was going to take place, and that's the reason she was there and her client wasn't. If she had, let me say this, and the reason I don't think that's in the record, her client would have been there because not knowing what the time was.
What I think she's referring to is that Brigham said the attorney for Mrs. Rosenstein finally asked, what time do we take up tomorrow? And my response was 10:45.
And she thought that was them having a meeting to discuss the future bench trial, not for the bench trial itself. Because that's in her sworn affidavit, which is in the record, that she had no idea that that was going to be starting the next day. And there was, I mean, your three, by the way, this is a post-answer default, according to the Lerma case out of the Supreme Court of Texas. That's exactly what this is. There's no question about that. And so you go to your Sunshine Bus case to see what the three factors are, and she satisfies all three factors there. I mean, hey, she didn't consciously disregard that. I mean, she had every reason in the world to want to be there to get this wonderful verdict now nailed down into the bench trial on possession of the children. And here you come, not only with this bench trial over the objection of counsel and the party who got the favorable verdict that's going forward, which just goes against the grain of everything within me, and I think most, in fact, I would think most people you would talk to, whether they're legally trained or not, would say, whoa, what do you mean? That can't be. But let me just say this about the ultimate result. She's awarded the right to make where they're going to live. But yet, the one who didn't get that, if you total up all the days, and it's in the record, they get 60% of the days.
Is it? There was a reference to a chart in here that showed that.
Yes, sir.
Is that chart, I didn't see it as an exhibit. Is it somewhere in the
It was a part of the motion for new trial.
It's in the clerk's record somewhere?
It's in the clerk's records. And it's got it marked out, and here you've got 60% of the days. Now, remember, we start off initially. Not only does he have them more than 50% of the time, but initially, until that first hearing of motion for new trial, he's got a ton of religious holidays. And the judge was definitely right in knocking out a whole bunch of those. But the order that you end up with on, quote, religious holidays is still out of balance because Jewish holidays are longer than Christian holidays. Now, that's a plain violation of the Establishment Clause as well as free exercise because you have a legal decision that's giving preference to one religion over another. I mean, that's slam dunk.
Was there a continuance motion orally or in writing filed when the bench trial started to begin over the objection of lack of notice?
Your Honor, there was no written motion for new trial. I am certain of that. No written motion for new trial. Excuse me, no for continuance. I'm sorry. No written motion for continuance. There was an oral ask that it be delayed until she could, whether the word, quote, continuance was used, but asking, let me get my client here, that's a continuance, whether you call it by that or not. And then.
And Brigham denied the right to get your client here?
Well, she had to go through the trial without her client, so obviously she was denied the right to have her client there. And certainly, you know, a bench trial, you don't have a bunch of jurors sitting out there in the hall waiting on something or sitting back. I mean, the judge could schedule that at any time. It's my understanding that in domestic relations matters that it's fairly common knowledge throughout that segment of the bar that following a jury trial, a bench trial doesn't usually take place the next day. It usually takes place several days later or maybe even longer than that. But for one to go immediately the next day, that's even contrary to what's normally done there. But the final thing I would say is this. Even if she had had the opportunity to be there, to reduce the child support based on the evidence that was there showing no change in his economic circumstances, is an abuse of discretion. That shouldn't have happened. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sharp. Mr. Staton.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. This was a case about two young children and what was in their best interest. Judge Brigham, for various reasons that are outside the record, was appointed and sat by special assignment.
Since you started off with that remark, so it was in their best interest to reduce child support?
Based on the testimony that was offered.
It was in their best interest to reduce child support, because you just told us that's what this case was about.
Well, I think the more money the children receive, the better. I'll concede that. But the child support was based upon the testimony that was uncontested.
Well, the case is really about this divorce.
Yes.
Which then affects the children dramatically.
Correct.
So that's what it's about to start.
Okay.
All right.
All right. There's no record of the trial testimony whatsoever. The only record before this court is arguments of counsel and the uncontroverted testimony of Howard Rosenstein.
We're talking about the bench trial now?
Correct. As far as the...
That it wasn't recorded or we have not been favored with it?
There is a transcript of the bench trial in the record.
Okay.
The due process problems raised by appellant, these problems concerning going to different judges, those were caused by appellant. They set those hearings in front of various judges. There's no evidence in the record that Judge Brigham gave Judge Cosby permission to hear the motion for new trial.
Whose court was this tried in?
This was tried in the 231st, but it was actually tried in an auxiliary courtroom by Judge Brigham.
Who is the sitting judge?
Judge Catterton?
Yes.
Ah, okay.
But they set these hearings in front of these various judges. We didn't do that. And
I mean, you're sounding like they're forum shopping. I suppose that somebody just files a motion and the clerk of the court sits it, and whoever happens to be that day, which apparently was never Judge Catterton, heard it.
Well, Judge Catterton had recused himself.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and so had pretty much every other judge over in the family court's building.
Okay.
And that's why Judge Walker specially assigned Judge Brigham.
Got it.
But in during the trial, he made it clear that I'm going to be the only one to make decisions in this case. And as you know, Judge Brigham goes from court to court. And I was completely taken off guard when I showed up in Judge Cosby's court. I thought Brigham was going to be sitting in Judge Cosby's court. And Judge Cosby heard the motion. When Judge Brigham learned of it, he set it aside as void. Judge Woodlock, there was no hearing on the findings of fact, conclusions of law. That just somehow got signed. Judge Brigham set them aside as void. And I've outlined the findings that Judge Brigham entered, and they are unequivocal that the appellant received notice that a hearing of visitation and access was going to be held the next day.
You know, now that you're on this, I'm sort of concerned. Some of these sound like they're subject to a sanction hearing as opposed to reciting the terms of the divorce, such as Lori Fox Rosenstein and misinformed the court of the out-of-pocket expenses. Well, that might be subject to a sanction, but I'm not sure that that has a place in a divorce decree, which
significantly affects the children. I mean, am I off base here?
Well, I think those are factors that he took into consideration. He also took into consideration that Ms. Rosenstein alienated the children throughout the pendency of the divorce. Ms. Rosenstein secreted the children, causing a writ of attachment for the children to be issued. Those are considerations when determining visitation and access. And as to this chart that you questioned about, that chart was attached to the motion for new trial that attacked the original decree.
So you take issue with the chart?
Well, as to the modified decree, the chart is not germane to the modified decree. Because
the modified decree only reduced the number of religious holidays.
It did. Originally, there were like 11 religious holidays, and it was reduced to 4.
So those 7 days makes a difference between 60% and makes it 50%, 7 days out of 365?
It makes it less than 50%.
Seven days makes a difference from 60% to less than 50%.
Well, some of the holidays are longer than one.
Okay, so just 7 days.
Yes, Your Honor. And there's absolutely no evidence in the record as to how long those holidays are. But when it was reduced to 4 days, Ms. Rosenstein has the children more than 50% of the time.
Okay, what do we have that shows that? Do we have a chart or do we have some accounting somewhere that we can look at to see if that's true? Not that I'm doubting your word.
No, Your Honor, but it's their burden to prove their point, which is 60% of the time. And what they're relying upon is a chart that was attached to the motion for new trial concerning the original decree,
okay.
Which...
You're saying the record now doesn't reflect what it is, despite your assertion a minute ago that she actually has them more than 50% of the time.
Correct.
There's nothing in the record to verify that one way or the other.
One way or the other.
Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead. But can't we take judicial notice just by looking at a calendar? I mean, assuming we have a calendar that identifies the holidays and how long they are, is there anything that would prevent us from doing that so that we could compute it mathematically?
Well,
you do want us to know, don't you, counsel?
Yes, I want you to know. Yes, I want you to know. But I'm not Jewish, but I do know that an Orthodox Jew and a modern Jewish person, they celebrate holidays differently. And so I couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you, but that's not our burden. Judge Brigham, under Rule 329, on his own, modified the decree at their request.
Okay, Jerry, looking here. The possession order says that father gets the children every first, third, and fifth week of the calendar month, beginning from after school on Wednesday until Monday morning. And on the days, the weeks that Mama gets them, he gets them Wednesdays. But she doesn't get them on Wednesdays. The weeks, he gets them for the weekend. His weekend starts after school on Wednesday. The first, third, and fifth weeks of every month, of the month. And so she gets them after school on Monday, and she gets them Tuesday. He gets them on every Wednesday that he doesn't have the weekend visitation. I mean, just looking at that, he gets them Wednesday from a period beginning when the children are regularly dismissed from school on Wednesday and ending at the time the children's school regularly resumes on Thursday. So he gets them Wednesday night, every Wednesday night. She gets them no Wednesday night of any week. Her weekends, apparently, are true weekends. And then he gets them every single Sunday morning from 8:30 a.m. until 1:30 p.m. Now, how is that 50-50? I'm confused.
Well, I haven't put a pencil to it, Your Honor.
Monday and Tuesday versus Wednesday through Monday morning? I mean, it doesn't take a pencil. I can't see that that's anywhere close to 50%.
Well, I included in our brief the amended findings of fact and conclusions of law to point out some facts that I think the judge used his discretion in determining what was in the best interest for the children concerning visitation and access. And that is some of the facts that came out at trial, which we don't have a record for, but fortunately we have findings on. And it was a horrendous trial. There were allegations of sexual abuse that the judge found to be false, alienation. The judge heard all this.
Well, now, but the jury heard what they heard, right? And there was a jury verdict. And mm-hmm. Wasn't the court obligated to make the judgment comply with the jury verdict?
Well, the judgment did comply with the jury verdict.
Okay. The jury only was charged on what? Theirs was just who had the right to determine primary residence?
Primary residence. That's it.
I think the problem just conceptually is if you say primary residence, that would presume perhaps that party would have more possession. But maybe we're confusing two different issues. The right to designate primary residence might not necessarily be the same as possession, which I guess does not have to be 50-50. Is that correct?
That's our position.
Well, actually, Your Honor, the jury answered 9 questions, not 1 question.
Yes.
For managing conservators, et cetera, exclusive rights, designate, et cetera, et cetera. So they're not there. Well, they're there for more than one purpose. Defame was a question. Damages was a question. Exemplary damages was a question. So they're hearing quite a bit of evidence.
Yes, it was a 2-week trial.
All right. Kind of across the whole spectrum of the divorce, the ramifications, the children, who's the conservator.
What does primary residence mean to you?
That is where the children legally reside. She's able to put them in the school district for that residence. That is their legal residence.
Primary means the one that comes first, the one where they mostly live, right? Seems to me Papa's home is their primary residence because that's where they are most of the time.
I think the judge entered a visitation schedule based on the testimony that was presented. The appellant did not show. It's very clear. Page 2 and 3 put out some extensive quotes from Judge Brigham, and he says it's unequivocal that he gave notice of the hearing in open court. Her appellant's attorney showed up, and I believe I cite a case in the brief, there's a presumption that if your attorney shows up, someone received notice.
For a hearing, according to his side, is he showed up for a hearing?
Well, and he also says that appellant's attorney objected to that hearing. Now, on page 419 of the record, a document that was submitted by appellant, there's an email from the court reporter, and she says, quote, there were no objections made on the record prior to the bench trial the next day, besides the one I transcribed for you after you questioned Mr. Rosenstein. So they made their objection, if any, at the end of the hearing.
So you're telling us that the lawyers there with no client going forward in a bench trial and made no objection?
That's exactly what happened. And the record bears that out. The red light's on, unless there's anything further.
Thank you, Mr. Staten. Yeah. Mr. Sharp.
Just a couple of things. First of all, the 60% computation is in the last motion for new trial. It is in the supplemental record, and you are able to take the order and compute the days and determine that after the modification in January, it's still 60%, because in January it was far more than 60% that he had. It went down from a higher figure down to the 60%. So time-wise, that's it. To me, as I said in the beginning, you have to deal with the jurisdiction issue. If you find your way to be able to get over that, then you can address the others. I do think it's interesting that before Judge Cosby, that counsel, in fact, Judge Cosby said, now, are you sure that y'all want me to hear this? And counsel said yes, including counsel who just argued before you for him to go ahead and hear the motion for new trial. So Judge Cosby asked them if they were going to object to him hearing it.
Well, because it sounded like it was Judge Brigham that objected.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct. In fact, when he came back and found out what happened, he's the one who objected and set it aside. So I think the record does bear out what is in our brief. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments today and, of course, all your briefing. Your case is submitted, and you all are excused. We will take